This talk was given by Patrick Yunan Kelly at the Zen Center of New York City. Yunan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ccnyc. Thanks for listening.
So, at the site of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion above it. Sit either in the full lotus or in the half lotus position. In the full lotus position, you place your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, you simply press your left foot against your right thigh. You should have your robes and belt loosely arranged and arranged in order. Then place your right hand in your left leg and your left palm facing upwards on your right palm, thumb tips touching. Thus sit upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor to the right, neither leaning forward nor backward. Be sure your ears are on a plane with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Place your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain open, and you should breathe gently through your nose. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale, and exhale. Rock your body right and left, and settle into a steady, immovable sitting position. So good morning. My name is Yunan. I use he and him pronouns, and this morning, I'd like to look at the subject of just the forms that we work with in Zen practice. You've probably noticed already, even if you just walked in the door, that we have a lot of very specific forms, postures, ways of working with the mind, ways of conducting a liturgical service. It can get very detailed, and so I'd like to ask, why is it any of this important, and maybe even more to the point, how do we take it up? So when I started Zen practice, I was really fascinated by this combination of focus on nitty-gritty concrete detail on the one hand, and on the other hand, this, you know, addressing these sort of what seemed like abstract or even metaphysical sort of questions about what is the nature of suffering, what is the meaning of life and death, the nature of time and consciousness. And on the one hand, and you know, then there's also stuff about how to clean a toilet, how to hold a spoon. And those it's interesting because the practice doesn't just hold them in juxtaposition. They're the same thing. And so I was fascinated by how does this work. I guess I still am. But also I've been feeling lately part of the reason I'm giving this talk is that Hojin asked me to. That's the main reason. But part of the reason I chose this topic, I guess, is that I feel that I'm not very good at these little details and that I often get lost in mind, you know, abstraction. So this is part of my way of trying to find a way back to the concrete, the details. To breathe a little life into them. And hopefully, I'll be able to offer you something of that as well. And if nothing else, Hojin got a little bit of time away from writing a talk so she could focus on her other duties. So the passage I read that I started with is it's Dogen, who is the 13th century Japanese monk who really started this particular tradition. He brought the Soto Zen school from China to Japan. And this text that I read from, it's one paragraph. It's not a very long text. It's maybe two pages. It's called Fukan Zazengi, which means something like universal recommendation of Zazen. This is Dogen's beginning instruction. So if you just had beginning instruction upstairs, this is, it's really the same thing. You probably already, a lot of it sounds familiar to you. And, you know, we might, at first you might think that an essay on meditation by a Zen master would have lots of, spend a lot of time focusing on maybe sort of, you know, sublime states of consciousness or awareness or the nature of reality. He hardly does that at all. It's mostly about how to arrange your robes, where to put your feet, how to hold your hands, stuff like that. He does say, he gives us one line on how to work with the mind. And that is, he says, think not thinking. How do you think not thinking, non-thinking? And that's all he says. And if you think about it, it's not just in practice that we encounter these specific concrete forms of how to hold your body, how to work with concrete details of our life. That's our whole life. You think, you wake up each morning, maybe make a cup of coffee. At some point you're walking down the street, you go out for groceries, you're brushing your teeth, using the bathroom. This is what our life is. It's just these little details. And in Zen practice, we take these details up and sort of, we hold them up. It's almost like the practice holds them up as an opportunity for us, maybe puts a little nice ribbon on it to give you something to work with and chew on. But it's really something that's already there. It's your life. It's already there. And we're just holding it up a little bit, bringing it forward. So we can look at this, ask, what is my relationship to the details of my life? When I have to do something like, I don't know, brush my teeth or sweep the stairs, do I get bored or impatient with it? Do I fall asleep to it? Do I experience it as a sort of curtailment of my freedom? Or maybe I get some reassurance from it. It gives me a sense of familiarity or control in what can seem like a very chaotic world. Maybe all of those, depending on each moment. So there's a, from the Soto liturgy manual for practicing in a monastery, I found this short little verse that you say when you're brushing your teeth. You say, you recite, brushing the teeth in the morning, I vow with all beings to care for the eye teeth that bite through all afflictions. Another translation has the fangs. So caring for your fangs is important. You know, bite through afflictions. I was remembering a few weeks ago, Hojin asked me to get some toothpaste, and so I did, and I didn't really pay much attention. Speaking of paying attention to details, and I brought back this toothpaste. It was activated charcoal, so it was like black. And she's all, "Why did you get me black toothpaste?" You know, it's worth looking at how we respond when we're presented, and especially in practice when we hold up some of these forms, like maybe in Oryoki when we have the formal meal in the Zendo, or someone tells you a specific way to hit the bell. How do we respond when we're presented with that? It's an interesting place of study. Maybe sometimes we go to a sort of perfectionism, we want to get it exactly right. Or maybe we rebel against it and just, you know, screw that, I'll just do what I want. There's all sorts of things we can do. We can turn it into a weapon and use it to judge myself or to judge you. You're not doing it right. I'm not doing it right. There must be something wrong with me or you. So here's another bit of Dogen going into the nitty-gritty. This is a small, tiny bit of his instructions for Oryoki, which is the formal meal in the Zendo. He says, the matter of setting out the bowls is as follows. First, gassho and untie the knot on the wrapping cloths around the bowls. Take the bowl wiping cloth and fold it up, once horizontally and into three layers vertically. Then place it horizontally between the bowls and yourself, along with the utensil bag. The wiping cloth is about 1.2 feet long. Place the utensil bag above the wiping cloth and then stretch out the lap cloth over your knees. And this goes on for pages in these sort of details. I mean, what is this just like being super fastidious or... Sometimes I feel that way. But I think he's really with the heart of it is what he's doing is he, this is sort of like counting your breath, but in the midst of activity rather than in stillness. It's like in beginning instruction, we say, see the thought, let it go, and return to the counting of the breath. It's sort of like a thread to help us, to help guide us through the labyrinth of our mind, which can get very complex and involuted, convoluted, full of twists and turns, especially when we take up some activity. And so he's giving us this this guide, these forms to work with, to practice. In the Heart Sutra this morning, we chanted form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness is exactly form. Emptiness here is, the Sanskrit is shunyata, which it's also often explained as meaning not just empty as in a sort of cold, dark void, like outer space, but it means something like empty of inherent existence, empty of intrinsic existence. You can sometimes translate it as boundlessness. So just wide open. Form is wide open. When Daido Roshi used to talk about this and the intro weekend, he would use the example of a room. And he would say, if you have a room, what happens what do you have if you take out all the furniture, all the walls, you take away the floor, you take away the ceiling, what's left? And he'd say, everything, the whole universe. It's wide open. In his commentary on the Heart Sutra, Dogen says, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And he goes on, he says, form is form, emptiness is emptiness. 100 grasses are thus, myriad forms are thus. It said that the Buddha was awakened when he looked up and saw the morning star after sitting through the night. Another master in Tang China was awakened when he looked up and saw plum blossoms. Another woke up when he had his leg slammed in a heavy door. He broke his leg. But our practice is not stargazing or looking at plum blossoms or leg breaking. It's not in the star or the plum blossoms or the broken leg. It's also not in robes or incense or even zazen. Form is emptiness. And yet, we do chant sutras that have a meaning. We chant the Heart Sutra. It's not all the same. We could, I don't know, chant the ingredients from the side of a box of Fruit Loops. It's not, we don't. There's a difference. Emptiness is form. Dogen goes on to say, form is form, emptiness is emptiness. In a recent talk, Hogan Sensei was quoting a verse from one of the traditional Zen texts, and he had this line. He said, a spiritually sharp person knows the tail when the head is mentioned. I really like that. In a sense, we can say form is form, because whenever we speak of form, emptiness is implied. Whenever we speak of emptiness, form is implied. Whenever we speak of hot, cold is implied, and so on. But usually we don't see it that way. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, dharmas are not dharmas, and thus we call them dharmas. Dharmas is something like phenomena. But all of this is not particularly helpful unless we actually practice it. I think this is why Dogen is so painstaking in his details. He keeps pointing us back to these very specific things because that's our life right now. That's all we have, really. But you know, it actually makes it a lot easier because you can't practice your whole life if you think of it that way, if you step back. What I have to do tomorrow, what I have to do the day after that, I have to deal with something that happened 20 years in the past, and it's past, so I can't do anything about it. I mean, you're going to get overwhelmed. But if you just practice this, that's manageable, just one thing at a time. Just really pay attention to what you're doing as you're doing it. In the fascicle that we're studying by Dogen, this Sangha, he says, a child offered sand to the Buddha and became King Ashoka in a later birth. So my question is, what is the handful of sand that I can offer in this moment? In this moment? In this moment, the tantric master Padmasambhava, who brought Buddhism to Tibet, says, my mind is as vast as the boundless sky, and my actions are as fine as rice flour. But these forms also, they also function in a way. It's not just about my individual practice. There's a sort of communal aspect to it, where they help us practice in harmony with the rest of the community, with the Sangha. You know, the three foundations of Buddhist practice are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. These forms can help us enter into harmony with each other, with the world, with self and other, into right relationship. You know, another word for this, a kind of old-fashioned kind of old-time word, is etiquette. It's about etiquette. Gary Snyder says, the etiquette of the wild world requires not only generosity, but a good-humored toughness that cheerfully tolerates discomfort, an appreciation of everyone's fragility, and a certain modesty. Lately, I've been, I've spoken about this before, I've been training and working as a hospital chaplain with a lot of people who are, well, they're in the hospital, so they're sick or dying. Not all dying, some of them recover, but, and not many Buddhists. Every once in a while there is one, but, so I'm investigating the interesting question of how to work with people from other or no faith traditions, which is a really interesting thing for me. Sometimes I say the Lord's Prayer with people who are Christian. I ask them, and if they want it, then I say it with them, and I try to muster as much devotion as I can. So, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. You know, I often say that I'm not Christian, but or that I don't even believe in God. But when I say this with someone, sometimes I can experience this sense of all the people who have taken refuge in this text in times of great trial or distress over the centuries. It's very powerful. I think some of our own forms work this way as well. You know, one of the, I was talking about this in one of the other my colleagues, one of the other chaplains, was asking me, how can you say the Lord's Prayer with patience when you're not Christian? You know, is that deceitful or hypocritical? It wasn't quite that strong. I'm sort of drawing it out a little bit, but I mean, it's a good question. You know, I'm sometimes asked by people if I believe in God, and sometimes I say yes, and sometimes I say no. But then I think, what about Buddhism? Am I even a Buddhist? I mean, it depends. When I put the raksu on my head in the morning and chant the verse of the kesa, yeah, I'm a Buddhist. But other times I'm not. When I chant the Lord's Prayer, I'm a Christian. Sometimes I'm an atheist. I actually don't think there's a contradiction there. It, you know, it seems that the form, the particular concrete form that gives us the most trouble is the one that we call self, one that we call me. We get really turned around by this one. It's the form we're most attached to, obviously. I've just been experiencing that to be born as a human being, it's a particular form of practice, human being practice. Maybe birds and rocks have their own kind of practice, I don't know. But I have my human being practice, and my particular human being practice. You know, we're all born into a matrix of biological, historical, social conditions. We all have our personal history. Mine is not the same as yours. But at the same time, we could call these karmic conditions. And although they're empty of inherent existence, we can't ignore them. We ignore them at our peril. And we don't need to ignore them because actually that's what we are. They're the raw materials that we have to work with. How wonderful. We have these forms to work with. And so we take up each detail. And as we take up each detail, as I brush my teeth, in a sense, the whole universe is brushing my teeth. It fills the past, present, and future. The whole universe rinses a dish. I was, all of this was really coming together for me maybe a week and a half ago. There was a longtime Sangha member here, Seiyu, who passed away. And I've just been feeling his presence a lot lately. He would come here every day for years and years and years. He was the liturgist, he was the gardener. He was just a steady presence. And he really... I've just been feeling how his practice still is in this place and helps bring this place alive for me, still. Anyway, we got a call that he was dying, and Hojin and I went over there, and we got there just as he was breathing his last breath. And we just held him and told him how much we loved him. It was intense and very stark. I mean, death is not pretty and very mysterious. You know, we talk about this, the great matter of life and death. And it was completely ordinary too. I mean, at the time, I wasn't really experiencing any particular emotion. I noticed that. I was just, you know, practicing my breath, arranging the sheets, afterwards washing the body, making a cup of tea for his husband, just doing my best to practice the details of what was happening. And I was, you know, I was reflecting. I saw him a few times in the weeks leading up to this, and I was struck by his... just his presence and his directness about what he was experiencing. he went right to the fact that he jumped right in and was talking about his death and his mortality, and which is not something I often experience in the hospital even. And I know, you know, I imagine he had moments of fear or terror or doubt, despair. But it seemed, as far as I could tell, like he was really practicing them. And so he was mostly concerned about the well-being of his husband, Matt, after he passed. I felt this was, you know, you could feel this as a fruit of his practice. Anyway, I don't even know what to make of the whole thing. I feel like it will be with me. I feel like I was given a gift in the fascicle we're studying. Dogen says, if you study giving closely, you see that to accept the body and to give up the body are both acts of giving. So I want to just close with a death poem. And this is I was reading a book by a man named Frank Ostaszewski, who is the one of the co-founders of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. And he tells this story in the book of this woman who spent the last few weeks of her life at the hospice, and he was one of her caregivers. And her name was Sono. And he said that he was in there one day and he was reading a book of an anthology of Japanese death poems. And so this is it's an art form, it's a tradition where people, as they near the end of their life, they'll just write a short poem summing up the whole shebang as best they can. And she was interested and she said, oh, that's interesting. I want to write a death poem. And so she did, and then she gave it to him and he wrote it down. So this is her poem. So, don't just stand there with your hair turning gray. Soon enough, the seas will sink your little island. So while there is still the illusion of time, set out for another shore. No sense packing a bag. You won't be able to lift it into your boat. Give away all your collections. Take only new seeds and an old stick. Send out some prayers on the wind before you sail. Don't be afraid. Someone knows you're coming. An extra fish has been salted. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.